Okay, welcome back, everybody. Oh, if somebody could please close those doors. It's just some background noise sometimes. Thank you. So, in general relativity, we do not have, in general, energy conservation or momentum conservation or angular momentum conservation. What can we do? In Newtonian gravity, there's a gravitational potential. Is there something like that in general relativity? One would think that not really, because gravity is on the left-hand side of the Einstein equation, and all of energy and momentum is on the right-hand side. So it would seem that curvature is something entirely different and doesn't belong into the energy and momentum budget. But it would be nice to have it if we could. It would be very nice to have something like gravitational potential energy. For example, for situations like this, where we have galaxies that collide with each other, then it would be nice if we could say that there is some sort of gravitational potential that they have, and they come in with some kinetic energy, and maybe there's energy conservation, momentum conservation. And these conservation laws are usually very useful for the purpose of calculations. And in particular, it would be useful because much of what's going on there is not just what we see. It's one thing to try to calculate, well, spiraling galaxies and how they interact with each other. But there is much more at stake here, because we know that most of what's going on is not visible. So it would be really nice to have as many tools as possible to study how matter moves, including dark matter. So is there a generalization of conservation laws in such space-times? It turns out that we can develop something like that. It's not perfect, and there are some choices to be made, but there is such a thing as a conservation of some kind of four momentum and angular momentum, as long as there are sufficiently nice asymptotic behaviors at space and time infinity. Now, to study that, let us resurrect the tetrad formalism. Remember, we chose the tetrad formalism because it gives us the freedom to choose bases and the tangent spaces independently from the choice of coordinates. And in fact, we can have the g mu nu is eta mu nu everywhere, because we can choose these bases whichever way we want. And that is, for example, important because then the gamma matrices for the Dirac equation can always be the same gamma matrices. Remember, they are defined as matrices that have an anticommutator, which on the right-hand side is twice the metric. If this was space-time dependent, we would have to have space-time dependent matrices here. Also, we use the tetrad formalism to express general relativity in terms of tetrads and therefore as a gauge theory, which is a starting point for theories of quantum gravity. And we found that the tetrad formalism for tensor-valued forms lends itself especially for issues that require integration. And that's because the only thing that can ever be integrated in differential geometry is a differential form. And so it is useful to take tensors and, if you want to integrate over them, to identify parts of them as differential forms, even if it's just a zero form or a one form, and then the rest is tensor valued, and then we can integrate this up. So we will use that formalism now to develop effective global conservation laws. So remember that in special relativity, energy and momentum conservation express the fact that translations in time and space of a solution lead us to another solution, because the physics is space-time translation invariant. And it's also rotation invariant, and that gives us angular momentum conservation. And of course, we saw this from the perspective of Killing vector fields, which generalize Noether's theorem. In general, of course, we don't have Killing vector fields, and so we don't have exact conservation laws. If you remember, this is always true, no matter whether there are Killing vector fields or not. This is just a Bianchi identity, but it is not a conservation law. If that index were missing, then that would say that the divergence is vanishing, and that would be fine, and we could derive a conservation law, but as it is, this is not a divergence, and we don't have a conservation law because of that.
Just now you were saying that this is from Bianchi identity, but that's only true for exact GR, no?
For what?
For just general relativity.
For general relativity, yeah. Yes.
But in general, this should be an independent thing from your Bianchi identity. Shouldn't this be...
Oh, yeah, well, that's right. Yeah. I assume GR here, because the Bianchi identity is what you get on the other side of the energy momentum tensor, that you have the G mu nu obeys that condition there. And then if the Einstein equation is true as well, it means that as well.
But that means... But this should still be true even if I don't have GR, right? Because stress energy tensor is, should be like on angular, like it's like the fluid dynamics thing, like it's always satisfying this thing. Can you argue it without Bianchi identity?
We covered that in one of the lectures. I don't remember exactly how it went.
But essentially, we don't need Bianchi identity to do this, right?
I think it's a Bianchi identity either way. I mean, for the G mu nu and for the T mu nu. It's not anything other than the internal structure of it. I don't think it is anything to do with the equations of motion of matter, or of gravity, for that matter. So in any case, this is not a conservation law. We have it always, even when there are no Killing vector fields, but it's not good enough to give us a conservation law. Only if space-time does not change in a particular direction, that is to say, only if there is a Killing vector, at least locally, then we have locally that solutions transform into solutions under these transformations, and therefore we get a conservation law. Now here's the idea. When we have regions of significant gravitational effects, for example, when there are two galaxies that are rotating and that are approaching each other, then in such a situation, we generally do not have Killing vector fields, because the space-time curvature is changing over time and over space. But we can consider this system in a large box. So this box B is a huge three-dimensional chunk of space. So it's a space-like hypersurface that we have truncated here, but very far out. And here we have the problem that we want to study the dynamics of. And in here, we don't have Killing vector fields. But if we make the box large enough, where the boundaries of the box are, there we could perhaps assume with great accuracy that space-time is basically like Minkowski space, that it is flat, no curvature there, and therefore that we have fully all of the Killing vector fields out there. Of course, it's not really true in the universe, because if you go far enough away from two galaxies, there will be more galaxies. But for the purpose of our calculations, we can just look at those in isolation and just take a box that's large enough and assume that we are having essentially Minkowski space out there. Well, then we would expect that in this box, there is a sort of total box energy, total energy in that box, which would have a contribution from the energy momentum tensor integrated up, but it ought to also have a contribution somehow from the curvature. And similarly with angular momentum. So energy and momentum of the box and angular momentum of the box, these things, it would make sense if we had them, given that all of this is embedded in a Minkowski space around. So ideally, we'd like to have something like what Newton had with the total energy being something like kinetic energy plus gravitational potential energy. It won't be exactly this, but something that combines the energy momentum tensor with something from curvature. So let's reconsider that concept then of gravitational potential. What could the gravitational potential energy be in general relativity? Well, one might think that it could be the Christoffel symbols. However, you know, just like in the case of electromagnetism, the A mu field, which would play the role of the Christoffel symbols. Here in general relativity, we have the Christoffel symbols that express the presence of curvature. Although they do not always express curvature. You could just use Minkowski space and write it in funny coordinates. And then, too, you would have non-zero Christoffel symbols that depend on space and time. And yet, there is no curvature. So the Christoffel symbols can't immediately give you a gravitational potential. But in fact, they can't give us a gravitational potential at all. And that's because the Christoffel symbols are not tensorial. So if you remember, we can choose always coordinates such that the Christoffel symbols vanish at a point. So we can choose any arbitrary point, and we will find a coordinate system at which the Christoffel symbols vanish. And therefore, that can't be the potential energy either. So we can't have localized gravitational energy in this way. And secondly, we should expect that in general relativity, if there is such a notion of gravitational potential energy, it must differ from the Newtonian notion in one crucial way, which is that gravitational potential energy has legs. You see, it can move. Whereas in the case of Newton, potential energy is just fixed, associated to a mass. In general relativity, if there is such a thing as gravitational potential energy, then gravitational waves are supposed to be able to carry it around. So that's different from classical gravity. All right, so we do not have a gravitational potential energy tensor, and the Christoffel symbols can't do it either. But there is something we can do using the tetrad formalism. And here's how it goes. It's technically quite tedious, so therefore I will first give you the strategy in some detail, how the strategy goes, and then I give you the gist of the technical stuff, but not all of the details. It just would be super tedious. So the strategy has several steps. The first step is that we take the Einstein equation, and if you remember in terms of the tetrad formalism, that's the form it takes. Here is the curvature 2 form, and if you remember this eta, this looks like a capital H, but I'm told it's an eta, it's a capital eta. That tensor is the Hodge star of theta alpha, theta beta, theta gamma. Remember, the thetas are the frame. They are the basis vectors in our cotangent spaces. So what we have here is that this is a three form. We take the hot star of that, that gives us a one form. Then we have a one form here, the wedge product with a two form. Remember, it's a two form not because of those two indices. It's a two form because two indices in the Riemann curvature tensor that are not shown now have been declared being the indices of the differential two form. So we have a two form here, the curvature two form. We have a one form. The wedge product between the two is a three form. And here we have the energy momentum tensor, but one index of it has been declared the index of a one form. So it's a 0-1 tensor valued one form, the energy momentum tensor. And then the hot star of that turns, of course, a one form into a three form. So we have three form equal to three form, and the valuedness also works out because these indices contract each other, so you have one lower covariant index and one lower covariant index over here. And this G is not the Einstein tensor, but it's the Newton constant. Okay. So we remember the Einstein equation in the tetrad formalism. And then the overall goal is, the overall strategy is, to reformulate it, to massage it in such a way that we have on the left-hand side the D of something, so some differential form on the left-hand side, of which we take the exterior derivative. And on the right-hand side, we have some other things. On the right-hand side, we have the energy momentum tensor, or the energy one form, and other things. So in other words, we take the left-hand side of the Einstein equation, which is just curvature terms. We have an earthquake or something. It's quite nervous. So we take the left-hand side with all of its curvature terms, and we split. It's getting worse. And we split the left-hand side into two pieces. One piece, which we keep on the left, and that's the exterior derivative. It's the exterior derivative of some terms. And the remainder of the left-hand side of the Einstein equation, we shuffle over to the right-hand side. And we add it to the T alpha. And that stuff that we put from the left-hand side to the right-hand side is now viewed as contributing to the energy momentum tensor. So we obtain a new energy momentum tensor, which consists of these two contributions. There is the T alpha, the old energy momentum tensor. And then there is this little t alpha, which is really terms that used to be on the left-hand side that were just made out of curvature. And those terms show up here on the right. Okay, so the overall strategy is we reformulate what is on the left-hand side, the curvature stuff, in such a way that some of it is the exterior derivative of a differential form, a differential two form, because the whole thing is a three form, so D of a two form is a three form. So we have some the D of some two form and some other terms, and these other terms we put on the right hand side and then declare them to being contributing to the energy momentum tensor. Now, why does that give us an advantage? On one hand, we can then say, okay, we have a gravitational contribution to the energy momentum tensor. But what good is that if we can't prove a conservation law for it, right? So, I mean, otherwise we could just take the whole thing and move it on the right. So, the point is that by rewriting the Einstein equation in this way, we have on the left-hand side that the D of something is this, which means that the D applied again is zero, right? So the D applied to this is zero, and therefore the D applied to that is equal to zero, and that will give us conservation law. So the first major point in our strategy is going to be to reformulate the energy Einstein equation in such a way that it takes this particular form. So we separate these terms into the D of something, so into a closed form, plus some other stuff, and that other stuff we put on the right-hand side, and say that it belongs to the energy momentum tensor. Then, having added the original energy momentum tensor plus the terms that we got from the left-hand side of the Einstein equation, we call this new energy momentum tensor tau. And the Einstein equation now takes the form d of something is equal to 8 pi g square root of g star t of alpha. Just by, I mean, it would be t plus t, but with this definition, it becomes tau. Then we applied the exterior derivative, the co-boundary operator again, and we obtain, of course, the d squared equal to zero. Therefore, the left-hand side is vanishing. Therefore, the right-hand side is vanishing. Therefore, we have that the d of this is equal to zero. So the exterior derivative applied to the Einstein equation gives us this. Now remember, these are three forms, right? Because this is a one form with a star, hot star, it becomes an n minus one form, which is a three form. The d of that is a four form, and that we can integrate over a space-time volume. So now let's use Stokes' theorem. Stokes' theorem says that when we integrate the d of a differential form over some manifold, then that's the same as if we integrated the differential form only over the boundary. So here we have the d of a differential form that we can integrate over a four-dimensional space-time region. And according to Stokes' theorem, this is the same as the integral over the boundary of that space-time region of just the differential form. So the d of the Einstein equation gave us this. Therefore, we can write 0 equal to the integral over it. And by Stokes' theorem, we have that 0 equal to the integral over the boundary of this space-time region. And remember that we are dealing here with a 4D integral. So D is a four-dimensional space-time region. It has spatial extent as well as temporal extent. It's a region in space and time. It's a four-dimensional integral. And this is the integral over the three-dimensional surface of this four-dimensional region, of this three form. Right? That's a one form, and the hot star of that is a three form. Okay, let's remember this equation as the equation with the x. So let us choose our space-time region over which we integrate in this way. Let's say upwards is the time direction, and to the right is a space direction. And of course, there are two more space directions, but let's suppress the plotting of them for now. So the region D is a four-dimensional box that has a spatial extent, but it also has an extent in time. If we look at a particular point in time, for example, at this point in time, then our four-dimensional box D, restricted to this one point in time, becomes a three-dimensional spatial box. And that's what we called B before, right? Like a box that contained two galaxies, for example. That was a spatial box at one point in time. And this is like a cylinder where you take the spatial box and you run it over time. So up here you have again the spatial box, and down here you have the spatial box. Okay, so D, capital D, is the whole four-dimensional thing. Capital B is any one of those equal time space-like slices, which is a three-dimensional volume. And then let's give a name to that surface here. Let's call it capital T. Now remember, we had this equation that we called x. It was the result of taking the exterior derivative of the Einstein equation and then applying Stokes' theorem. The equation said that when we integrate this tau over the boundary of a four-dimensional box, we get equal to zero. We get that this is zero. But remember, the tau consists of the old-fashioned energy momentum tensor plus stuff that we moved from the left-hand side of the Einstein equation, curvature stuff that we moved to the right. Exactly what it is that we moved to the right, we will discuss in a moment. This is still just the strategy of it. So this integral over the boundary here of the four-dimensional region therefore splits into three contributions. Namely, this box, this box capital D, has as its boundary down here this spatial hypersurface, B, up here that spatial hypersurface, B, but it also has this boundary and that boundary, which of course you should also view, you know, going around in not just the x direction, but also the y and the z direction. So this total integral over the surface of D, over the boundary of D, is then the following. Just spelling this out, what the boundary of D is, it's the integral of the over the integrand of the integral over just the first box, which is to say the box with the two galaxies in it, at an early time t1, so that's time t1, plus the contribution from that surface, which is again the spatial box, but now at time t2, plus the integral over these boundaries out here, which are in principle very far out. You know, so far out that over there we assume that space is empty and not curved. So no contribution from the regular energy momentum, but also no contribution from the curvature. Also, a subtle thing is that when you do these integrals, then this surface integral is always defined in such a way that this integral over the surface, for that you need the line, if you spell it out explicitly as an integral in coordinates, you need to know what the normal vector is to your surface. And that normal vector is, in Stokes' theorem, always pointing inwards, which has the effect that, and we will come back to that in a moment, which has the effect that here, for that integral, so for this integral, the normal vector is pointing inwards, which means forward in time. But when you come to integrating that part, the normal vector is again pointing inwards, but that means now pointing backwards in time. It's just a subtle thing that will make a difference of a minus sign a little later, just to remind you of that. You see, when you have a multidimensional integral, there is no well-defined up or down, but there is a well-defined in or out. And the integral is defined with respect to normal vectors to the surface that point inwards. So now, we use that this integral can be assumed to vanish. Remember, that's the integral, this integral, which is over these areas here. So why are we assuming this to vanish? It's actually not trivial, but I get to that why it is not trivial in a moment. For now, let's just say we are far away enough from the action in here that we can assume that there is no matter in here and no curvature. Therefore, there is no contribution to tau from either the regular energy momentum tensor or from the curvature terms that we moved over from the left-hand side of the Einstein equation. So we are saying that we are considering a box large enough that we are far away enough from the action that there's not going to be a contribution to this. Okay, so we're assuming that both the contribution from the energy momentum tensor and from the curvature part are vanishing here. But that means that the previous equation, when that term drops out, simply means that the sum of these two terms is zero. So this is the integral over the new energy momentum tensor that also contains curvature terms, which will play the role of a gravitational potential. So therefore, we have that the integral over this integrand over the spatial box at time t1 plus the integral over the spatial box at time t2 is equal to zero. But as I mentioned earlier, in this integral, when you actually carry it out, the reference vector that points orthogonal to the surface is pointing inwards, and here it's pointing inwards, but here it means forward in time, here it means backward in time. If we fix that, if we change the definition of this integral such that it is with respect to a normal vector that points outwards, so that it points forward in time, then we pick up a minus sign here. But that means that this integral then becomes equal to that integral, because if it has a minus sign, you can move it on the other side. And that is the conservation law then, right? Because what we have is that when we integrate the new energy momentum tensor consisting of the old-fashioned matter-based energy momentum tensor plus the curvature pieces, then if we integrate it over the box at early times, we get the same value as if we integrate over the box at late times. So it's not true locally that we have a conservation law, but it's true globally, right? So we have that in the box, entire box, we get a certain value for each alpha, and that's the same before and after. It's the same at T1 as it is at T2. So we define the total so-called ADM, Arnovit-Diese-Wiesner four momentum vector, which is given by these integrals. So P mu is that value. And it is a four vector that is assigned to the entire box. It's a global thing. It's not a tangent vector anywhere. And what we have is that this four vector is conserved in time. If you wish, you can view it as a four vector with respect to the Minkowski space that is prevalent outside of our box, that is prevalent far out.
I just wanted to clarify something. The hot star of that thing is a 0-1 tensor value tree form, right? So when you integrate this thing, your left hand side.
That's correct.
Becomes a 0-1 tensor value 0-4.
Correct.
Okay.
Well, not 0-form, it's just a number, right? Because we integrate it out. And it's not a function of x anymore.
Because
it's integrated. But you're right that this index here, the 0-1 tensor valuedness, translates into the 0-1 tensor valuedness of that.
Yeah, so you're integrating out the form part of that.
That's right, okay. Exactly. Yeah, good point. So remember that the energy momentum tensor has two indices, but one of them we declared to be a one form and suppressed that index, and we're left with one index here. So now that one form, we take the hot star off, and then we get a three form. And that three form can be integrated over a three-dimensional spatial box. And so the three form has gone away, and we've integrated it up, and we just get a number, right? And that number, but I mean, for every index value, right? So we still have a 0-1 form valuedness. And that's what's left over here.
This only works if we have a global concept of time, right?
Yes, we need here that Yeah, actually, we come back to that question. What we need here is that this boundary term vanishes, right? So we need that there's no contribution from either energy momentum or from the curvature terms. So we need to be far out enough and basically have Minkowski space out there. It's a non-trivial business because you might think, yeah, what could go wrong? Well, what could go wrong is that gravitational waves might move out there. You see? And let's say you have some big action going on in that box. That means the gravitational waves might propagate out there. And they would keep contributing to the to that part of the new energy momentum tensor, to the gravitational part of it. And that's why there's a modification to that concept that we will get to a little later. So if gravitational waves is something you need to worry about, then you have to define your boxes a little bit differently.
But you define the parameter time one, but that's no longer like a local coordinate that applies to the whole box. How do we know that we can define a time for the whole box? Because it's a big region and there's a lot of stuff going on in there. How do you know that you can have one coordinate system?
Actually, yes, this is getting to the point of it. Remember that the box is defined as a spatial volume at a particular point in time. But then what is a particular point in time depends on how you slice your space-time into space-like hypersurfaces. And yeah, I guess I can already mention it then. You can use that freedom in many ways. You can slice in many space-like ways your space-like hypersurface. And in particular, you can choose your slicing in such a way that the slicing basically tends towards the, as you go further out in space, the slicing sort of bends up in one of those diagrams where you have time upwards and space to the right. The slicing could, intuitively speaking, bend upwards so that it becomes almost 45 degrees. At 45 degrees, it would be light-like. That wouldn't be right. We have to remain space-like. But you can get arbitrarily close to 45 degrees. And in this way, choosing either to do this or not to do this, you either trap your gravitational waves or you don't in there, because the gravitational waves would travel with the speed of light. So yes, all of this is relative to the slicing that you do. All right, so we need to determine the T of alpha. So now that we have the strategy, right, now we need to carry out that strategy. And remember, it consisted initially in doing this. Main step was we take the Einstein equation, and we look at the left-hand side of it, the curvature terms, and we split them into two pieces. One piece that is hopefully the d of something, so it's the exterior derivative of some two form, and another piece that is not, and that we just throw on the other side. Now clearly, if that works, it's not going to be unique. Because you could always add to the left-hand side and to the right-hand side the d of something, right? So you take some tensor and you take the d of it, the exterior derivative of it, and you add it on the left-hand side and you add it on the right-hand side, right? You can always do that. You can always take an equation and add to the left, you add 8, and on the right, you add 8. It's still true, right? And so here, too, you add on the left-hand side the d of some differential form, and you add, let's say here, you add the d of a differential form, and here you add the same d of the same differential form. Then it's still true. And you still have d of something on the left-hand side. But on the right-hand side, you have something else, because you added the d of something here, right? So this is not unique. Choices have to be made. Choices have to be made into what we put here and what we put there. For the moment, let's just register that we have this freedom to add a closed form here on on the left and the same one on the right. An exact form, because it's a D of something, right? We can always add an exact form on the left and on the right without disturbing that structure. The structure being having the D of something on the left and something else on the right. For now, we just keep that in mind and we just go ahead and see what we get. Okay, so that's what we want to do, because then we can use that D squared is equal to zero, which means that the D of the left-hand side is zero, which means that the D of the right-hand side is zero. And then, if you remember, we applied Gauss's theorem, Stokes' theorem, and we got a conservation law out of it. Assuming that we chose our space-like hypersurfaces in such a way that we could neglect the boundary terms. And how we do that, again, implies a choice, and which choice we make may depend on the circumstances, such as whether or not we need to keep track of gravitational waves. Okay, so how will we then fix the choice? I anticipated a little bit, and then I'll go a little bit more into detail later. So as I said, we can always add an exact form on the left-hand side and on the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. And that means a difference on the right-hand side then. Right? So if we manage to write the Einstein equation in this form and we add an exact form here, an exact form there, it does make a difference in the shape of the new energy momentum tensor that contains both energy momentum of the old kind and curvature kind of energy momentum. So it makes a difference over there, not over here, but it makes a difference over there. So in other words, the very definition of the energy momentum tensor is not unique, of the new energy momentum tensor is not unique. So how can we fix that choice? Well, we'll fix that choice in such a way that the new energy momentum tensor, this is supposed to be not the T, but the tau. This is the sum of the old-fashioned energy momentum tensor plus the new curvature pieces. We want that this is a symmetric tensor. If you remember, in general relativity, the energy momentum tensor always comes out symmetric automatically because it is the functional derivative of the action with respect to the metric. And the metric is symmetric, so the derivative of the action with respect to the metric is also symmetric. But if we succeed in our program of doing this, namely, we split the left-hand side into the D of something and some rest that we throw on the other side and add it to the T, then there's no guarantee that what we added here is still symmetric. I mean, here we don't see the symmetry anyway, because, I mean, this T actually has two indices, right? But one of them is suppressed because it's considered the one form index. But really, just like the ordinary energy momentum tensor has two lower indices, this too has two lower indices. And there was no guarantee coming from the left-hand side that this stuff that we throw here on the right-hand side, that this curvature-based contribution of to the new curvature-based contribution to the energy momentum tensor, that this actually has symmetry in its two indices. So we will use the freedom to add exact forms to the left and to the right in order to ensure that what comes out here, what we totally, at the end of the day, add here on the right-hand side, is symmetric under the interchange of the two indices. Now, you may wonder, why is that? Well, it turns out that we need this if we want to have conservation not only of this ADM4 momentum, but if we also want to have conservation of angular momentum. Then we can build this angular momentum out of the 4 momentum and, so to speak, position variable. But we will need for that the symmetry of the total energy momentum tensor. So that's what we will use this freedom for. Remember, in principle, it's we wouldn't actually need this. We do get a conservation law no matter what. It's just differently calculated, different numerical values, but it's still conservation. But if we want for energy and momentum, but if we want a similar law for angular momentum as well, then we need that. Now, one can prove a theorem which says that this is actually always possible. You see, that's non-trivial too. Is it actually always possible to add an exact form on the left-hand side and the right-hand side of the Einstein equation such that the new contribution to the energy momentum tensor, the gravitational contribution to the energy momentum tensor, makes the total energy momentum tensor symmetric? And that is actually possible. So the T alpha, if you remember, was the gravitational contribution to the energy momentum tensor. And we suppressed one index because we declared it to be a one form. But if we spell it out, it is T alpha beta, and then the frame field here. And that's T alpha beta. That's what you want to be symmetric. And here is the outcome of a long calculation, which shows that the unique energy momentum tensor contribution that comes from curvature, which is symmetric, is given by this expression here. Or more accurately, it's hot star. So that's one form, but this is a three form. So the proposition says that there exists a unique decomposition of the left-hand side of the Einstein equation into an exact form plus a curvature part, such that the curvature contribution to the energy momentum tensor is symmetric. And the claim is that this is what that contribution, what the gravitational contribution to the energy momentum tensor is. Let's quickly go through the structure of it. The capital eta alpha beta gamma delta is a zero form. It's obtained by taking the frame field four times. This one form, one form, one form, one form. The whole thing is a four form. The hot star of that is a zero form. So that's just a zero form. And then here you have a three form, because the connection one form, which the connection one form, which the basis in the space of one forms is in total a three form, and here the same structure. So we have a three form here on the right, and we have a three form here on the left.
Is this going to cause problem when I write this in tensors, because a hot star of a tensor is not a tensor? Like there's a, this Landau-Lifshitz thing, if I consider it as a tensor because of the hidden index, right?
Mm-hmm.
This won't be a tensor, right? Because hot star adds that epsilon thing.
No, I think it's okay. It's okay because you see, we are holding the basis. I mean, basically, I think what you have in mind is that the transformation structure is no longer the right one. But remember that these guys no longer transform. See, if you change coordinate system, it doesn't affect it. The Jacobian doesn't act on it anymore, right? Yeah. Okay, now we won't go through the entire proof of why this exactly is the unique right-hand side, it's the unique contribution of the curvature to the energy momentum tensor, but we'll go like halfway. So here's the proof. Let's look at the Einstein equation in the tetrad formulation. Remember, again, a three form on the right, three form on the left. Here we have three thetas and the hot star of it that gives us one form, and the curvature two form, the whole thing is a three form. Now, we will use the second structure equation. Remember what the first and the second structure equations were? The first structure equation is the definition of the torsion, which is zero in general relativity. if you grant me that for a moment. That's an interesting question. And then the second structure equation is the definition of the curvature. Namely, second structure equation says that the curvature 2 form can be expressed in terms of the connection 1 form in this way. You take the exterior derivative of the connection 1 form minus that. That was the second structure equation. Let's put that into the Einstein equation. So we just replace the curvature 2 form here by its expression in terms of the connection 1 form. If you wrote this out in the usual formalism, you would have here the you would have the Riemann curvature tensor, and you would express it in terms of Christoffel symbols. That's what it would be. And now we have not the Riemann curvature tensor, we have the curvature 2 form, and we express it in terms of the connection 1 form. But the connection 1 form is, of course, just obtained from the Christoffel symbol. Okay, so if we do this, if we express the Einstein equation, re-express it with the curvature 2 form written in terms of the connection 1 forms, then we obtain on the left-hand side these two terms. We have that this term here is a minus 1 half times that times the h, that's this term. And we have minus 1 half times this term times that. So that gives us a plus 1 half. And then this is this omega, that is that omega. And on the right-hand side, we are carrying forward this. Okay. So now, the first term here has the exterior derivative acting on the omega, but not on the eta. We can write this term by something like integration by parts, but without integrating. We can write this as the d of everything in here. So now the d acts on both the omega and the eta, instead of just acting on the omega. If we make up for it by subtracting the other term, by subtracting the term where the d acts on the capital eta, right? So the this minus that is this term here. Okay, so let's keep in mind that this is the Einstein equation here. We're just rewriting one term in it as these two terms. Remember what we are after. We want the d of something on the left-hand side of the Einstein equation plus the rest, which we throw on the right-hand side. And here, we obtain d of something. That's a good start. Right? So that wasn't the d of something. That was the d of just that little bit. And then we had that whole thing here. But we need that on the Einstein equation on the left-hand side. We have it's just the d of something plus the rest. Now, that's d of something. And then here's some rest. And that's the rest here. Let us rewrite that piece as well. That's the exterior derivative of that capital eta here, which is obtained from three frame fields theta. Now for that we calculate the absolute covariant derivative of the capital eta, which if you remember is obtained by taking the exterior derivative on it, plus, and then these effectively Christoffel symbols as well. So that's the exterior differentiation part, that's the covariant differentiation part. Remember, the capital D does both. It does the exterior derivative, it also does the covariant derivative. So we know from earlier that D of that is equal to zero. But it is also this, by just spelling out what the capital D does. So now we can put all of these things together. The Einstein equation was this. And on the left-hand side, we have now a leading term, which is the d of something. Here it is, the d of something. the d of something. And then we had that term. But this term actually gives us lots of terms, because it's minus 1 half omega beta gamma, and then all of that stuff here. Right? Because we have that the d of eta, d of eta is equal to minus of all of this, right? You can put all of this on the left-hand side. So the d of eta can be written in this way. So So we have that the Einstein equation, so this plus that equal this, now takes the form of the d of something here, and then 1/2 omega beta gamma, this one, and then the veg of all of that stuff here, this stuff, that goes into that bracket here. And we still have this term, which goes into here, and the right-hand side is that. So what we have now is that the Einstein equation's left-hand side is actually split into two pieces. One piece, which is an exact differential form, it's the d of something, plus some other stuff, which is a candidate for gravitational potential, because this is what we're going to throw on the right-hand side now of the Einstein equation. So all of that stuff, which is made out of the Christoffel symbols, ultimately, all of that stuff goes here onto the right-hand side. So that we obtain d of something, namely exactly d of all of this, is equal to 8 pi g, and then it's the energy momentum tensor of energy of mass and energy, plus star t alpha, where the little t alpha is basically all of this, all of that stuff here. And in principle, we could call it a day with this and say, well, we're done. We now have a conservation law. We defined a little t, which is a contribution to the right-hand side of the Einstein equation. And on the, on the left-hand side, we have the exterior derivative of something. So if we apply the d to this, the left-hand side goes away, and we have that the d of that is vanishing, and we get, via Stokes' theorem, a conservation law. But in this form, if we just throw all of that stuff onto the right-hand side, then that contribution to the energy momentum tensor, that gravitational contribution to it, is not going to be symmetric. So what we need to do is add to the left-hand side and to the right-hand side another exact form, the d of something. On the left-hand side, it will not disturb us because it's still the d of something then. But on the right-hand side, these extra terms from this new exact differential form can, hopefully, but there's a theorem that guarantees it, chosen such that this contribution is symmetric, just like this is. Now, if you want to read up on exactly how that extra term is found, it's a little tedious, but you can find it, for example, in the book by Straumann that is in the references to this course.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. This last line here, d something equals 8 pi g of blah, 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 right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that something kind of like the wild part of the Riemann tensor? Because if I set t equals to 0, right, then I'm still left with the pseudo tensor, which is supposed to be the remainder of the wild tensor.
Sorry, because the last step, can you repeat that?
Yeah, so if let's say I consider vacuum space-time, right?
Yeah.
Then the first term on the right-hand side disappears, right?
It is.
But the right-hand, the second term might not disappear. So if it doesn't disappear, that means the left side should be the remainder of the Riemann tensor that doesn't come from matter, which is the wild part, is that it?
I suppose you can view it this way, that's right. So if there is no energy or momentum present, that would vanish, and then you would have that the d of something is equal to that. And but it wouldn't be a clean version of the wild curvature. It would be just something, some messy expression of it.
But if, let's say, my space-time only have gravitational wave and nothing else, then the first term disappears, but the...
Well, no, actually, let me see. Actually, not really. You see, when you start with the Einstein equation, then initially the wild curvature does not occur in it at all. It's not on the left-hand side, and it's not on the right-hand side, right? Because Because when the Einstein equation is rewritten in terms of the Ricci tensor equal to something, something energy momentum tensor, then you see that the Ricci tensor vanishes if and only if there is no energy momentum present. So therefore, the Einstein equation, which has only Ricci curvature in it, it has the R mu nu on the left-hand side, and it has the Ricci scalar, which is the contraction of the R mu nu. So the left-hand side of the Einstein equation doesn't have wild curvature in it, and the right-hand side of the Einstein equation, of course not, it's just energy momentum tensor. So there just isn't any wild curvature to go around. And what we did is we just took the Einstein equation and just split things on the left-hand side. And so, if there was just wild curvature present, I think generally we wouldn't get anything here, we wouldn't get anything there. However, if we now add an extra exact differential form on the left and on the right, such that the energy momentum tensor here becomes symmetric, then we have contributed something there. Then we have contributed something. And there's no guarantee in general, there would be no guarantee that the term that we have to add in order to achieve symmetry of T is free of wild curvature. In general, it will have it.
So just check again. So the Einstein equation that we write on top, right? We already transferred the wild part into the right-hand side. Is that it?
No, it's neither. You see, the Einstein equation can be written in this form, where it is R mu nu equal to some constant, and then you have T mu nu minus G mu nu T, right?
Yep.
And therefore, you know, that by definition doesn't contain any wild curvature, right? And so on the right-hand side, there's no curvature at all. So the Einstein equation doesn't say anything about wild curvature.
Oh, right, okay. That means you have to, so even if I want to consider like what kind of space-time it is, I actually have to specify Einstein field equation plus the wild curvature separately.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Right, so if you want to see exactly how to construct the terms that you have to the exact differential form that you need to add on the left and on the right, such that the addition on the right makes the T symmetric, then please look it up in the text by Straumann. So now, in principle, we have all the ingredients to calculate the conserved ADM energy momentum tensor. Namely, we take this tau, which is the energy momentum tensor, or energy momentum one form in the tetrad formalism, which consists of both the conventional part and the new gravitational part, and we integrate that over a spatial volume, such as a huge box that contains two colliding galaxies. And then we get this four-vector P mu, which is a four-vector with respect to the Minkowski space that's prevalent outside of the box. There is a theorem that has been proven for these ADM four-vectors. Namely, it has been shown that P naught comes out positive in this calculation. P naught comes out positive if the dominant energy condition holds. Remember what the dominant energy condition was. We had the weak energy condition. Weak energy condition said that T naught naught for the conventional energy momentum tensor had to be positive, which said that for co-moving observers, the energy density should always be positive. Then the dominant energy condition said that if you take a time-like vector, and you contract it with the energy momentum tensor, then that should still be time-like. the interpretation of that was that it's well motivated from conservation laws. Namely, if there is a time-like killing vector field, then if you contract the energy momentum tensor with the killing vector field, you get a four vector of energy and momentum, which is conserved. You get an energy momentum conservation in this way. Now, when your time-like vector field that you're contracting with the energy momentum tensor is not a killing vector field, then the flow of energy and momentum that you get in this way is not conserved. But we want at least that it's a time-like vector, right? We want that the energy momentum, even if it is not conserved, we want it to flow into the future. We want it to flow in a causal way. So the dominant energy condition says that even though the vector that you get by contracting a time-like vector field on the energy momentum tensor doesn't describe a conserved quantity, at least we want it to be time-like. That the flow of this so defined energy, so defined momentum, even if they are not conserved quantities, should be time-like.
Why can't it be null? I should allow gravitational
I think,
energy.
I don't remember how strict the dominant energy condition was on that. It might allow that it is not. We definitely didn't want it, we don't want it to be space-like, but I think you're right. We should allow it to be light-like as well. Okay, so a theorem has been proven, the so-called positive energy theorem, which says that if the dominant energy condition holds, then P naught is larger than zero. Okay, now finally, let's look at angular momentum. Let's choose coordinates which become Cartesian-Minkowski space coordinates very far out, you know, outside of that box in which the galaxies are colliding. And then we define, just like we defined the ADM 4 vector over here, we can define for these coordinates x mu, we can define now this matrix m alpha beta, which is x alpha, and then you take the stuff t beta, and you know, it's just like xp minus px, just like a generalized 4D version of the angular momentum. And you can then prove that this quantity has the property that d of it is equal to zero, and therefore you get a conservation law, and the quantity that's conserved is then this quantity here. In principle, the steps to show that are very similar to what we did above for the four momentum, except one non-trivial point is that if you want to go through that calculation and prove this, you will see that one of the requirements in proving this is that the tau is symmetric. I mean, it's not easy to see here because it has only one index and that's an upper index. But you can rewrite this, of course, with this index down and then make the one form index visible as well. That thing you need to be symmetric in order to show that this is conserved. And that's why we chose the exact form ambiguity to be resolved in that way.
So ADM4 momentum, is it still a rank 1 tensor or is it going to be rank 2 now?
First of all, it's not really a tensor anymore, right? Because this thing is arrived at by integrating. So it doesn't live in anybody's tangent space. It's something that is approximately a good concept, living in it, transforming with respect to the Minkowski space that you have asymptotically.
So the left-hand side of this quantity, what kind of object should this be?
Well, let's just go back to the four momentum here. So remember what this is. This is a 0-1 tensor valued one form. I think we went through this just a little while ago, right?
And this one becomes three form. So the one that comes out is a rank 1 tensor, right?
That's right.
But the bottom one, the J alpha beta, would it be?
That would be rank 2, yeah.
So it would be rank 2 tensor?
Yes. Yeah, in that sense, in the Minkowski sense, yes. Exactly.
But usually we think of angular momentum as a vector.
Oh, yeah, but that's wrong. Yeah, no, you shouldn't. No, it's really components of a 4x4 anti-symmetric.
Yeah, because this is the more Lie algebra way of thinking about it. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, you know, it's obtained by, you know, the angular momentum vector that you're referring to is obtained by taking the cross product between two vectors, the x and the p vector, right? But the cross product of two vectors doesn't really give you a vector.
Right.
Yeah. It just so happens that it has as many components and almost transforms in the right way, but it doesn't transform properly when you change signature, for example. Okay, so finally, let me just alert you to the fact that we may want to take into account gravitational waves. So in principle, we may have to take into account gravitational waves because when we say that we throw away boundary terms and in our integrals, you know, very far out in space, then the logic is, the way we presented this, I presented this like half an hour ago, was that if you are far away enough from those galaxies, then there is no matter out there, and therefore there is no gravity out there. There's only Minkowski space, and therefore there is no contribution to the energy momentum tensor. There's no contribution either from the traditional energy momentum, because we assume that space is vacuum out there, so there's no contribution this way. But we also assume that there is no curvature, and therefore also the new contribution to the energy momentum tensor vanish. And therefore, we just said that this integral far out there doesn't contribute. I can show you the picture again. Here it is. We said that this integral is important, that integral is important. This is the early integral over the box, this is the late integral over the box, but these boundaries far out there in space, these integrals we dismissed and said that they vanish. But it could be, of course, that even though there's no matter out there, could still be gravity out there. There could be vacuum solutions. There could be wild curvature out there that could be contributing. And that in general can happen. And so what you may want to do, therefore, is be very careful with how you choose your space-like hypersurfaces. Because you can choose your space-like hypersurfaces in such a way that, for example, they bend up at almost 45 degrees in such a way that the gravitational waves basically can't catch up with it. Or you can not do that. And this leads to slightly different definitions then of what the four momentum is, or the angular momentum is. And you will find them in the literature under the name of Sachs-Bondi instead of ADM four momentum. Right. So I think we are done almost in time today. Okay? Right, that's it. Any questions? Huh? That's great. Yes?
Could you go into a little more detail about how that slicing you're talking about is done in order to like avoid calculating the like effect of the gravitational waves in the conservation law?
Well, I've never done these calculations myself. I do not know a lot of details about this. Basically, the difference it makes is that if you you can choose space-like hypersurfaces in such a way that you effectively have a horizon there. You know, when you take an observer, for example, that is an observer that is uniformly accelerated, will have an event horizon. There will be a huge chunk of the universe that is beyond the reach of a uniformly accelerated observer. There's a lot that the universe, that the uniformly accelerated observer will never learn about, because stuff cannot catch up with this observer. That observer has an actual event horizon. The causal past of the boundary of the causal past of the future infinity of a uniformly accelerated observer is non-trivial. This observer actually has an event horizon. And so, similarly here, you can, by choosing your space-like hypersurfaces suitably, again, approaching the 45-degree line, just like a uniformly accelerated observer would, you can, in effect, block out certain things. It's as if you defined for yourself a horizon. And so in this way, then, it does make a difference for the energy budgets. I can't really tell you any more details about this. I don't know exactly when people would do the one thing or when they would do the other. All I know is that what matters is whether you have to worry about gravitational waves, in which case, if they do carry away a significant amount of energy, or they don't. Because it's easier if you don't have to choose some weird space-like hypersurface slicing. It's easier if you don't have to do that. But sometimes you do have to, because gravitational waves are important. I mean, for example, in the case where you have two galaxies colliding slowly with each other, and it takes like billions of years for them to collide. In this case, the amount of gravitational waves that's being generated is negligible. So you wouldn't worry about that. But of course, if you take two black holes that collide, or two neutron stars, or a neutron star and a black hole, then gravitational waves make a huge difference. They account for the balance of energies in there, and then you would need to worry about that.
Yeah. Also, I think Bondi-Sachs four momentum can tell whether gravitational waves carry energy, because of the space-like slicing, ADM, four momentum is constant even if your object is emitting radiation, because your gravitational wave is accounted for by the space.
Yeah, that's the thing. And so the conservation would be violated in this case, because if your gravitational waves carry energy out of that region here, right, then it wasn't a good approximation to say that no energy goes through this. So we should have, if gravitational waves are important and gravitational waves move through there, then we should have taken the gravitational wave contribution to these integrals into account. We could not have dropped them. But on the other hand, you can choose your space-like hypersurfaces so that they bend up in this way, and you basically don't have that boundary. Right. Okay. So the thing is that we are basically done with our curriculum, as Aishan already noticed. So we have some freedom with what we do with our last lecture on Friday. We could just make it a freewheeling discussion of everything to do with gravity. Or I could talk about some ongoing research, or whatever you have in mind. Or we could talk about the projects and the essays. Or we could do all of this. And just see how we do with the time when we try to do all of these things. Any preferences?
All of them.
All of them. Okay. Yeah. I mean, basically, we went over time so much. It's as if we had, you know, like we saved like 5 lectures or something by going over time so much. All right. Okay, so on Friday we do free willing discussion. We do what's interesting in research nowadays, and you're free to ask questions about the essay and the project. All of that in any sequence. All right. Okay, see you on Friday then.